Support for this public radio podcast comes from Society for Human Resource Management, HR, leading people, leading organizations, shrm.org, and by Cargill, collaborate, create, succeed. This is how Cargill works with customers. Stories online at cargillcreates.com. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Details at putnam.com. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
I swear, Ben Bernanke spends half his life testifying before Congress. So I guess it's not surprising he's got his speech down pat. The economy's going to get better, he says every time. Maybe. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. Pandemic flu is a real threat, but there are steps you can take to prepare. More information at takethelead.pandemicflu.gov. Sustainability coverage supported by Calvert, mutual funds, college savings, and retirement investments in companies committed to responsible environmental, social, and governance practices. Calvert.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Great to have you with us today. It's the 14th of February. And you want to know why economists drive regular people nuts? Because they say things like this.
At present, my baseline outlook involves a period of sluggish growth, followed by a somewhat stronger pace of growth starting later this year, as the effects of monetary and fiscal stimulus begin to be felt.
Followed seconds later by this.
It is important to recognize that downside risks to growth remain, including the possibilities that the housing market or the labor market may deteriorate to an extent beyond that currently anticipated, or that credit conditions may tighten substantially further.
In other words, we're fine, unless the things that have been happening for the past 6 months keep on happening. That was Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke on Capitol Hill today testifying before the Senate Banking Committee. He had company at the witness table. Christopher Cox, the chairman of the Securities and Exchange Commission, was there, as was Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson. Senators from both sides of the aisle asked Mr. Paulson why the government's not doing more about the subprime crisis. And after a bit of that, he let us know what he really thinks.
I didn't create this problem. I'm working to try to do something about it. If this effort doesn't work, then we'll make adjustments in it. But again, there are going to be, I don't mean to sound heartless, because I'll tell you, when you're there and you look at the abuses and you look at the predatory lending abuses and you look at some of the, it's heartrending. But what we're doing is trying to deal with it. And all I can say to you is, if you've got other ideas for me, for Pennsylvania, send them on in.
We ought to note nobody took him up on that offer. One more item now to keep you up at night if you're the type to worry about these sorts of things. Two New Yorkers were on Capitol Hill today as well, the insurance commissioner and Governor Eliot Spitzer. Bond insurance was the name of their game. Spitzer said we could be just days away from a bailout of the $2.4 trillion bond insurance market. Wall Street didn't think much of what any of those guys had to say. The major indices all dropped 1.5% or so, just the latest in a long string of volatile days in the markets. But it's not only ordinary investors who don't know what to do with their money anymore. Research out today says professional money managers are more risk-averse now than they've been at any time since September 11th. Our New York Bureau Chief Jill Barshay has more.
Money managers don't like cash. It doesn't earn them much money. They prefer to invest in stocks and bonds. But they've been selling hard over the past 2 months. Nearly 5% of a typical portfolio is now parked in cash. So says a new survey by Merrill Lynch. Lakshman Achathan is the managing director of Economic Cycle Research Institute. He says the pros stock up on cash when they think stocks and bonds are too risky.
It's like if you were speeding down a highway and you came upon a very dense fog, you would certainly slow down before going further.
Achathan says the more cash investors have, the safer they'll be if markets tank. But hoarding cash is bad for the economy.
Businesses need access to funding from money managers. Now, if the money managers are averse to purchasing stocks or bonds and they'd rather hold cash, in essence, it's putting a lid on the amount that businesses can grow and economic growth.
Some say ordinary investors are forcing the pros to take on more cash. Russ Kinnell is the director of mutual fund research at Morningstar. He says individual investors are selling out of their funds, so managers need cash on hand to meet withdrawals.
Some U.S. stock funds are getting redeemed because last year was a tough year for them, and money may instead be going into foreign stock or even emerging market funds, which have been doing better.
If Kinnell is right, that means fund managers might not have much cash to fuel a market rally once the economy improves. In New York, I'm Jill Barshay from Marketplace.
The television networks are probably happier than you and I are that the writers' strike is over, mostly because now they'll be able to sell ads. CBS and ABC announced today their big spring lineup previews, known as the upfronts, are going to happen as scheduled. No word yet from NBC. They had been thinking about scrapping the whole thing. It is an expensive decision. Networks sell about $9 billion worth of ad space at the upfronts every year. On Wall Street today, more selling than buying. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Ben Bernanke and Henry Paulson were wearing regulation Washington attire this morning when they testified. Dark suits, white shirts, ties that weren't too flashy. Elsewhere in the Capitol, though, flash was exactly the point today. Fashion designers were making the rounds. They're trying to convince Congress to let them copyright their designs. Jeremy Hobson has more.
What kind of bag are you looking for?
I need to know brands you have.
They got everything there. Just let's go there and take a look at it. No problem, all right?
On New York's Canal Street, you can get knockoff handbags, shoes, clothes, anything, at a fraction of the retail price. They look like the real thing, but they're not. In fact, you can head into any H&M, Zara, even Walmart, and you might find something that looks just like a high-end designer piece of clothing, but isn't. Attorney Alan Coblance represents the Council of Fashion Designers of America. He says under current U.S. law, all this is perfectly legal.
It's not just that you can sell the copy of a design. It's also that you can even brag and advertise the fact that it is a copy.
Coblance is leading the charge for a bill in Congress that would allow fashion designers to copyright their designs for 3 years. How a dress is cut, for instance, the exact shape of a bag, the subtleties of fashion. He says the industry is missing out on tens of billions of dollars a year in New York City alone because of this problem. But there's no need for a law, according to UCLA professor Cal Raustiala, who did extensive research on this issue.
The fashion industry is an example of an industry that does not seem to be suffering from a decline in creativity or innovation in fashion.
In fact, he says, all the knockoffs actually help speed up the fashion cycle by creating trends.
And trends are really the heart and soul of the fashion industry. A trend is a series of things that look somewhat alike, right? And so one of our concerns is that this bill will make trends more or less go away.
Well, that's a brilliant reasoning. I mean, it's like saying that robbery is a wonderful thing in the economy because by way of replacing the stolen goods, it encourages industrial production. I mean, it's absurd.
They may not be able to convince Alan Coblance, but critics of the proposed bill argue it would lead to an unimaginable amount of lawsuits, giving the edge to big designers who can afford expensive lawyers. I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
The president may or may not be leaving for Africa tomorrow. He said today he's going to wait and see what Congress does on the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Bill. The House and Senate have passed distinctly different versions of the warrantless wiretapping program. The current version expires Saturday. If and when he does make the trip, the president will see what some experts are calling an agricultural revival on the continent. G. Pascal Zachary covered Africa for many years for the Wall Street Journal. And Mr. Zachary, where is the president going to see this revival playing out?
Well, there's quite a few countries in East and West Africa in particular. Countries like Nigeria, the most populous in Africa, and Uganda are producing increases in food that are greater than population growth. They're exporting food. They're beginning to reduce reliance on food imports. And farmer incomes are rising in many African countries.
How are they doing it, though, increasing those yields? Is it traditional Western agribusiness, or is it something else that they've hit upon?
Well, it's a combination. I think that the aid donors have realized the key is not just giving better seeds to farmers in Africa, but finding them buyers. So in Malawi this past year, farmers made record incomes in part because there were buyers ready to buy all that stuff. And farmers in Africa are showing themselves to be pretty darn responsive to having customers.
Are we at a point yet where they're competing with American farmers?
Yeah, actually, it's true. In Nigeria and in Uganda, there are growing outputs of rice, and that's reducing the imports of American rice. In many parts of the United States, you can buy fish that comes directly from the Nile, called Nile perch. It's airlifted into the United States. I saw flowers in the Kampala airport, barcoded, ready to go on Kroger's shelves.
Does that production for the export market, though, hurt local African consumers? Are they having to pay higher prices?
No, just the opposite is happening paradoxically. As the capacity of these small holders, and they're almost all small holders, 2, 3, 5 acres, as their capacity improves, they're producing more for the local market as well. So some of the differentiation is around quality. So the higher quality Arabica goes for export, higher quality maize may go for selling across the border, but there's more food all the way around.
But things obviously aren't perfect in Africa. I mean, you have extreme poverty, regional conflicts, there's climate change. There's a lot that farmers have to worry about.
No, no question. And I mean, what we see in Kenya, one of the agricultural powerhouses of Africa, a country that has been sending hundreds of millions of dollars worth of food a year to Europe. Obviously, the breakdown in their political stability is adversely affecting these farmers. In a lot of ways, it underscores the need for political stability in these countries, for farmers to prosper.
What does it look like when you go out to a farm in Africa someplace? I mean, does it look like a traditional big business operation?
No, it looks more like Ireland of the 1930s or 19th century America. Very small farms. There are almost no tractors, some farm animals, no electricity. But the real bright spot on the horizon is the mobile phone. Almost all parts of rural Africa now have some mobile phone service, and it's created a great sense for the farmers of reality of what urban markets are like. It helps them sell their products and makes it easier even for aid donors to reach them.
Mr. Zachary, thank you so much for your time.
Oh, thank you very much.
Coming up, one woman slows down to savor a sweet flavor.
And I realized that when I was concentrating into the tasting of one chocolate, I felt the complexity, the intensity, and that it was much more interesting than watching TV.
But first, let's do the numbers. That glum note Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke struck today caused some nail-biting on Wall Street. The Dow Industrials clipped 175 points. You get it? Clipped nail-biting. 1.4% to end at 12,376. The Nasdaq filed away 41 points, 1.7% to finish at 2,332. The S&P 500 trimmed 18 points, 1.3% to close at 1,348. Yesterday's snap up your tech bargain streak ended after Goldman Sachs said demand might drop for Intel products and took the chipmaker off its buy list. Intel unwound 3.5% today. Nvidia plunged more than 16%. The graphics chipmaker said production costs are rising. Swiss bank UBS lurched 8.25% lower. It disclosed holding tens of billions of dollars worth of risky debt exposure. Lehman Brothers and Morgan Stanley both slid about 1.5%. Goldman Sachs fell 2%. The 10-year T-note fell. The yield on that one rose to 3.82%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the American Public Transportation Association, working toward energy independence with 10 billion transit trips per year at publictransportation.org. By Advanta. Advanta salutes small business, the brave ones, the risk takers, all those who chase a dream and make their own way. And by Siemens. From grade school to grad school, Siemens supports America's next generation of innovators with Student Science Days, plus scholarships and awards for students, schools, and teachers. Want more from Marketplace? It's all on our website. You can stream, download, or subscribe to podcasts of all our shows. And we have text of most stories, plus special reports and the Marketplace Toolbox. Check it out at marketplace.org.
The Marketplace Datebook, here's a glance at events coming up Thursday. In Washington, the Federal Reserve reports on industrial production for January. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon meets with President Bush at the White House. Their discussion is expected to cover climate change, counterterrorism, and human rights, among other issues. And the first teddy bear went on sale on February 15, 1903. The stuffed toy was named for President Theodore Roosevelt. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. There are digital traces of most of us out there in internet land, but Facebook users got a bit of their privacy back this week. The social networking site changed its mind and decided to let users delete their accounts if they want to. Commentator and college freshman Ben Kaznoka says we all ought to just accept that social networking does more good overall than it does evil.
Science fiction author David Brin warned a decade ago that in the future, privacy would be impossible. Our best option would be to live in a transparent society. Welcome to the future. Teens and adults today are choosing to publicize where they live, what they believe in, what their friends are like. On the internet, it's easier than ever to disclose yourself. Yet we always hear the same thing from concerned parents and employers. What's happening to privacy? It's easy to dismiss today's hyper-publicness as the doings of rash teenagers or egomaniacal bloggers obsessed with their personal minutiae. Easy and wrong. In fact, a rational cost-benefit analysis shows good reasons to live a naked life. That's because there are benefits to transparency. Take increased social connectedness. Losing track of childhood friends used to signify adulthood. Now every old friend is a Google search away. Soon, 50-somethings may still be in touch with their high school friends. And by disclosing your passions online, you might even make new friends. I know I have. Openness brings people together. Look, it's true that transparency can have its costs. Down the road, today's teens may regret posting those drunk pictures and gratuitous blog entries. But since 97% of teens and tweens say they belong to a social network, everybody will have a screw-up or two from their adolescence. This creates what some call mutually assured embarrassment. If you smear me with that post I wrote at age 15, I'll spread photos of you sucking on a beer bong. And transparency isn't all or nothing. Today's networks have detailed privacy settings you control. As blogger Jeff Jarvis has put it, publicness is good so long as we decide how public we want to be. Like it or not, the transparent society is here. Most of my friends are out on the web, where we tell the world who we are and what we think. Those who are still fully clothed shouldn't be surprised if folks start asking, "What are you trying to hide?"
Ben Kaznoka is the author of My Startup Life, What a Very Young CEO Learned on His Journey Through Silicon Valley. You can find his online profiles pretty much everywhere out there. Send us your thoughts if you got them. Our website is marketplace.org. Over the past year in our series, Working, we've met people who clear landmines and smelt metal. We've introduced you to lobster divers and basketball scouts. Today, in recognition of the date, we offer another snapshot of life in the global economy. A French woman whose job it is to keep the world safe from bad chocolate. John Miller caught up with her in Ecuador.
My name is Chloé Dutra-Roussel. I am an expert in tasting chocolate. I have also followed very closely the international trends because there is a lot of politics, there is a lot of cross-influences. So this is kind of information I can provide to companies, what areas they should invest on or what products they should launch. I am very lucky that I was born with a very acute nose. For the tasting of chocolate is one of my biggest advantages. But having a sharp nose has also a lot of disadvantages. For example, if I am in a plane and the person 3 seats away has been sweating too strong or ate garlic, I need to change seat. We are now in an old plantation. The trees are between 25 and 30 years old. I arrived in Ecuador 2 days ago, and I had spent just before 11 days in a tour in Asia, moving from taxi, hotel, airport, restaurant. And then I spent 24 hours in Paris, mainly to change suitcase. And I am here for a 3-day workshop organized by an association of cacao exporters that have the intention to develop many chocolate brands and not just export cacao. People tell me often that I have the best job in the world because I travel so much and I eat chocolate for free. Well, first, there is not a free lunch, I think you say in English, because the time I spend around chocolate is a time I don't spend learning music, drinking with friends. It would be much more simple for me to just go and buy chocolate and enjoy life. We are in the terrace outside the hotel where is hosted the conference, and we have only 10 minutes to have lunch. When I was 14, I started to taste chocolate to find the best pleasure out of my pocket money. And I realized that when I was concentrating into the tasting of one chocolate, I felt the complexity, the intensity, and that it was much more interesting than watching TV. I have applied this methodology of listening my body to listening to my need for rest, or where I want to go for holiday, or if I want to be with this person or not. The more you do things that are not in tune with you, not only is a waste of time, but you also harm yourself. And one of the characteristics of our society is that we hurt ourselves and then we spend time and money trying to heal what we managed to hurt. There is a chocolate revolution going on. It started with the revival of dark chocolate as a gourmet food and many new brands selling fine chocolate. And all these companies try the same tricks. They use the same words, they tell the same stories to sell very different products. At the moment, for a consumer, it is almost impossible to get the truth. Many companies approach me and they ask me to write a few nice words about their products so they can publish nice words and my name would be a seal of quality. These things I refuse. When I do chocolate tasting, I usually prepare a glass of warm water because the cocoa butter sticks to the mouth and the warm water will dissolve the cocoa butter and really clean much better the palate. So now I'm going to taste another chocolate. I know the chocolate. It's a good friend. So it's little ovals that are all scratching between themselves, so they don't look very sexy. I'm very happy nobody's tempted and only me. When I look at it closely, I can see in the cut that there is no bubbles or particles, so you can already see it with your own eyes that it has been properly tempered. Now I'm going to approach it from my ear. And this is a quite sharp snap, so it's again a proof that it has been properly tempered. And now I'm going to smell. It has some fruit notes. It's always hard for people to understand that you can feel fruits in the chocolate. Well, when you are exploring the taste, the aromas of fine chocolate, you need to explore what we call the aromatic families, floral, fruit, vegetal. It's exactly the same families that are analyzed in the world of perfume, tea, coffee, olive oil. So we all use the same vocabulary. So now I'm going to taste. After 10 seconds of cutting the chocolate into small pieces, you just stop any movement with the mouth, close your eyes, and concentrate. Don't swallow. It should melt in such a harmony with the body that you will not even notice it is melting. It's not something that you will be conscious of. The first thing you feel is not the aromas, but more an acidity. You have like sparkles on the side of the tongue. And once the acidity tempers, appear some red fruit notes. The red fruit notes are very powerful and at the same time elegant and light, and they last very long. It's a good sign for a chocolate. So this chocolate is complex, intense, elegant, with no aggressivity but a very strong personality. The chocolate we just had is the Mangiare from Varona. Varona has another chocolate called Guanaja, and I like to describe the difference between Mangiare and Guanaja. Like, if you close your eyes and you imagine a handsome man dressed up with a suit. I'm a woman, so I always refer to a man. In the case of the Guanaja, it would be a kind of cheruti suit, black with white lines, very elegant. And the Mangiare would be the same handsome man, but with a purple suit from Kenzo and a pink tie, also very handsome, very elegant, but a bit eccentric. A lot of people ask me, what is your favorite chocolate? Of course I have my favorites. Everybody has its favorites. It is quite subjective. The type of chocolate you like is not only related to the quality of the chocolate, but also to your past. Everyone should keep in a little box of treasures, not a physical box, but in our head, their favorite chocolate bar when we're a child, because the memories are even more powerful on the taste than reality sometimes.
John Miller produced that piece for us. Working is a co-production with Homelands Productions. You can hear earlier installments and learn some more about the finer points of tasting chocolate at our website. It's marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, offering more of what you want in a retirement plan. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
And this final note, Mike Huckabee is going to take a detour off the campaign trail this weekend. He'll be in the Cayman Islands speaking at the Young Caymanian Leadership Awards. He's not actually going to get an award. He's not all that young, and he's not a Caymanian. But the former governor of Arkansas will be getting paid. Since leaving office back in January of last year, Huckabee has been represented by the International Speakers Bureau down in Dallas, Texas. His lecture fees run as much as $25,000. Huckabee's campaign manager told reporters last night, hey, the guy's got to pay his mortgage.
I'm Mike Huckabee, and I approve this message.
Nah, not really. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow fell 175 points. That's 1.4%. The Nasdaq chipped away 41 points, 1.7%. The S&P 500 dropped 18 points, 1.3%. Kevin Arnovitz, Patty Hirsch, Karen Lowe, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. Coming up next time on the program, tough decisions for struggling homeowners.
We're not making choices about, you know, should we go up to the casinos for the weekend? Or we're making a choice about whether or not our son can go to summer school.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.